I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. We human beings have had a long-standing problem. On the one hand, we want to bond deeply with another person, to be fully known, accepted, and loved for who we truly are. On the other hand, we crave novelty, something new, something different, something exciting. Our guest, evolutionary biologist Justin Garcia, puts it this way in his new book. Humans are wired to be socially monogamous, but not necessarily wired to be sexually monogamous. His book is titled The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. He argues that intimacy is hardwired like sex, and that we need it to survive, like food and water. He also says we're on the edge of an intimacy crisis, with more people living alone and unpartnered. So today on The Connection, mating, dating, and love. Justin Garcia is a sex and relationship researcher. He's also the executive director and senior scientist at the Kinsey Institute, one of the leading, if not the leading, institute for the study of sexuality in the world. He's also chief scientific advisor to the dating company Match. I should add that our conversation may not be appropriate for children. That said, Justin Garcia, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's begin where your book begins. You were on a research field trip, if I can put it that way, and you're visiting a brothel outside of Las Vegas, and you look at a menu of the various options, and the most expensive one is something like $20,000. What did or what does a client get for $20,000?
Yeah, and it was really an amazing place, and we had this wonderful tour. And there are all these specialty rooms, and you can have particular outfits and particular sexual behaviors. But the thing that people were spending the most money on, were willing to spend the most money on, and what the women who worked there were charging the most for, was what's called the girlfriend experience. And that was not just an hour session in a room, but simulating a date. So you would set up, they would set up a table, you would share a bottle of champagne, you would have a conversation. Often it would last an evening. So the most expensive thing you could get in an illegal brothel, a place you could pursue almost any type of erotic desire, was intimacy, was acting out, was couching a sexual experience in a what felt like a romantic date.
And you said it was a house favorite among the high rollers. So what does that tell you? What does it tell us?
I think it tells us a lot about... You know, and what's interesting about these legal brothels, and they're about an hour outside Vegas, the one we went to, that when folks go there, they often want to pursue a fantasy. They want to pursue something that they've always wanted to try. Maybe they're worried about trying it, but in their own relationships, or they're having difficulty finding romantic and sexual partners. And of all the possible things they could try, of all the things they could experience, of all the novelty, what people were willing to spend the most money on, what people were willing to drive an hour out into the desert for, was a simulated date. And often sex still was a part of it, not always, but often. But really this idea of connection, that for me was, and I, someone who studies romantic and sexual relationships, it was just this shocking in many ways, but it also made sense. But just to see it and to hear it was so shocking to realize people will spend this much money. This is what we want. This is what people want above all these other things. Now, certainly there are still people also getting, you know, putting on a dog outfit, and there's all sorts of things that go on in those places. That happens. But the most desire, the cherry on top, as it were, was couching this in terms of connection with another person.
There are so many different ways to be intimate. Your book is called The Intimate Animal. Obviously, sexually or physically, also emotionally, intellectually, probably creatively. So what makes intimacy a biological drive, as you see it, the way sex is a biological drive?
Yeah, I think we often think, certainly us evolutionists do this, but all of us, when we think about sexual behavior, we understand it in terms of sex and reproduction, and most sexually reproducing species engage in certain types of courtship patterns. We understand a sex motivation, a sex drive, as being important for the survival of a species. But I think where we've not done such a great job, and I say we, I mean academics, people who study these things, and all of us, as we think about our own relationships, is appreciating the power of connection. So humans have formed these intense pair, what we call pair bonds, romantic bonds, for over 4 million years. And so much of our sexual lives, so much of our reproductive histories occur in the context of these long-term bonds. So to talk about sex in human societies throughout time, and to do it without being serious about the relationship context through which it happens and how that context shapes everything from how satisfied you are to the experience of the outcomes, we were missing a piece of the puzzle. So for me, honing in on this, that piece of connection and intimacy, not just any connection, but really for me, intimacy is a deep connection, feeling seen and heard and known. That was this critical piece. And the more I dug, I realized it wasn't even that it was an important context. It also had its own evolutionary lever that was shaping so much of who we are.
Well, let me go way to that way back machine and talk about the time, as you describe it, when human beings went from crawling on all fours to being on 2 feet, on 2 legs, to being bipedal. You say what happens is that sexually, instead of, I guess, mounting from behind or however our ancestors had sex, we began to have sex looking at each other face to face. How did that change intimacy? How did that change our human relationship?
And so many species, when we think about mating behavior, often you don't want to spend a lot of time in it because when you're mating, you're distracted. You're distracted from the environment. You're not paying attention to predators. And we, as humans, we think of that as a good thing. Often you want to be distracted when you're focusing on your partner. But being face to face, only a few organisms do this. Some other primates do mate face to face. Gorillas have been studied occasionally in the field, chimpanzees occasionally in the field. But the fact that as our anatomy changed and actually where everything, like where our erogenous zones were, where the genitals were, as we started engaging in face to face coital behavior, we then were watching each other's expressions. And so much about breathing patterns, eye contact, face, feeling each other's faces. Now, I want to be cautious because sometimes over the last several decades, some researchers have used that to kind of run with ideas. So, for instance, one of them, there's all these ideas about breasts and women's breasts and how they were important for courtship. Well, in fact, when we look at the anthropological evidence, I think it was 13 out of, if I remember correctly, it was 13 out of 188 societies in one study that sexualized the breast. So in many places, although there's erogenous zones in it, the primary focus was not. So we have to be cautious of how we think of this. But the face-to-face, it meant that the sensory experience started to change. So much about paying attention to your, really focused on your partner and not. When you're looking at each other, it's not just one mating with the other, and you're looking at the environment for predators. And that also is part of a story that we engage in mating over long periods of time. We're not, rabbits, let's say, which often engage in a short burst of mating, and then they move on, and they move on to a new partner, and pregnancies happen. We're actually what we call a low fecundity species, and that means that the rate at which copulatory behavior turns to conception is fairly low. Now, that is insight into something about us, about the relationship context of our mating.
Is it also about the pleasure that is associated, hopefully associating with mating as well? I mean, I think we understand for men orgasm and ejaculation, but you say in the book that we really still don't entirely understand what female orgasm is all about. I might be putting words in your mouth, but it's still a bit of a pleasure, a question, I should say, a little Freudian slip
It is a pleasure,
there, right? About what that has to do with evolution.
Exactly. And it's one of the big debates in sexology of really what is the function of orgasm. In males, we understand that it's associated typically with climax, and that's associated with reproductive outcomes. But in females, it's more complicated. And there have been a bunch of theories. A wonderful book by a colleague of mine, Lisa Lloyd, looked at some of these theories. And I talk about that in The Intimate Animal, that they, how do you, there's some arguments that with orgasm, for instance, that there's a tenting that happens in the cervix and uterus. And does that mean that it increases the likelihood of sperm reaching the egg? There's all sorts of, there's some arguments that with orgasm in women, you have a surge of oxytocin, and that's associated with pair bonding, associated with feeling connected, the so-called cuddle hormone
Right.
that's involved. But it turns out there's not really great evidence for any of these arguments. We don't fully understand how and why. The fact is that we do experience pleasure with sexual activity, and we're able to. But even then, when we look in behind, kind of peel back some of those layers as we look at the data in heterosexual intercourse, for instance, fairly low numbers of women experience orgasm from penetrative sex activities alone. They're often things like petting, oral sex, kissing, we found in our studies. That is insight too into saying, well, this isn't just a strictly mating behavior in terms of what we see in some animals where you're just engaging in intromission. You know, when we look at rats in a lab, the male mounts the female, and then they both go on their way.
Right.
That it's couched, that the pleasure experience, the fertility experience, that it's all couched in these longer emotional connections. And part of being face to face means you can see, is your partner in pain or are they having pleasure? And can you cultivate that? Do you want to cultivate that?
But I wonder whether, pleasure and procreation going together, that it helps to explain how we are still here as a species.
That's one of the main arguments, is that the having pleasure associated with sexual activity may motivates us to keep doing it, and then that was what motivated our coital behavior, our reproductive behavior. But there's some interesting nuances. So some things that we take for granted, for instance, are that humans, females in particular, can engage in sexual activity across the menstrual cycle. And I say can because in many species, females are unable to mate when they're not in estrus. So, in fact, I just mentioned rats. They're a great example. In a lab rat, female lab rats have what's called lordosis, the back arches. And when they're not in estrus, they can't arch their back enough. So, although a male rat will mount them, there's nothing
Wow.
really happens because they're not arched enough. The physics really, the anatomy doesn't align. So the fact that, and then there are other species that the vaginal opening entirely closes when not in estrus. So the fact that we have the capacity to enjoy sex, that we have the capacity to have sex across menstrual cycles, we have the capacity to have sex way after our reproductive years. That's all part of an important as it's a part of our evolutionary story, and important to understand the role that sex has in our lives. And it's not just reproductive, but pleasure has all these other parts of defining our relationships and ourselves.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We obviously
Sure.
have a lot more to talk about with our guest, Justin Garcia. He's the executive director of the Kinsey Institute. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's also a sex and relationship researcher, and he's an author now. He's got a new book. It's called The Intimate Animal: The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about why the need for intimacy is the key to our survival and well-being. Again, our guest is evolutionary biologist Justin Garcia, also the executive director of the Kinsey Institute and author of a new book, The Intimate Animal. Well, let's talk about this push and pull of intimacy. As you write about it, that we sort of have these sexual impulses that are in conflict with our need for love and intimacy. I guess from an evolutionary perspective, why this conflict? What is that about, and what does that say about us?
Yeah, I love that you bring this up, because often we can sometimes think that an evolutionary process leads us to a place where things are easy or great or always fulfilling. And that's not always how the process works. I often think of, we have this one pipe that we breathe and eat through, and it's really a messy design. And it would be nice if I was like a porpoise with a hole that you could breathe through and don't choke on your lunch. And but that's not how evolutionary works. It's that when selection happens, it's off of traits, and you kind of move forward with each new trait. That's how adaptation happens, by relative increase in a population. Relative change over time. So, okay, when we think of our relationships, one of the things that I think is interesting and a challenge, and at the core of a lot of what I'm interested in, is that we can understand that humans have this pattern of sexual monogamy, but not, I'm sorry, have a pattern of social monogamy,
social,
but not
right.
always sexual monogamy. And in fact, as evolutionists, as biologists, we talk about social and sexual monogamy as two different things. And but so often when I'm working with psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists, sometimes in the human sciences, we just say monogamy. And in the popular conversations when we talk about relationships, we say monogamy. And I often think, oh, my gosh, but those are really, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the relationship structure, social monogamy, or fidelity, which is sexual monogamy? Now, to the question you brought up, which is really a great one at the core of these tensions, are that there's two different evolutionary mechanisms, the levers being pulled. We see selection on two different things that are in conflict within each of us. And that's selection for social monogamy, forming pair bonds, something our species has been doing for over 4 million years. Only about 3 to 5% of mammals form these intense pair bonds. Cooperative raising of offspring, cooperative mutual territory defense, mutual nest building, this idea that you have a co-pilot in life. So that becomes the relationship structure. But then there's this question of sexual fidelity. And it turns out what we see is that while we have an adaptation to form intense bonds, we also have an adaptation for sexual novelty and variation. And in some cases, when we talk to couples that have been together long term and they still have chemistry and passion, we did one study looking at what keeps passion alive in long-term couples. And what we find is that they find ways to keep that novelty within their, they pull it into their primary relationship. But for so many people, we find that that other lever, the novelty lever, pulls them into other directions. It pulls them often away from their primary partner. And it sets up this inherent challenge that we have in our relationship.
You talk about stayers and strayers. So people that, I guess, stay within a relationship and those that wander away. Mm-hmm. How big are the sex differences when it comes to men and women staying and straying?
This is a great question, in part because it depends. It depends on a lot of things. You're not going to like this.
I'm going to be
such a scientist. I don't have a solid answer. And it depends on two reasons. One is, how do we measure infidelity? And you, in studies that look at patterns of infidelity, you can ask, have you ever in your life engaged in infidelity? Mm-hmm. That's one measurement. It's not necessarily a great one, because you could have talked to someone who's married for 50 years and they say, well, I engaged in infidelity when I was 17, you know. And so you can ask about lifetime. You can ask within the last 12 months. You can ask about emotional infidelity, sexual infidelity. What does physical infidelity mean? Was it a hug? Was it a kiss? Was it intercourse? So the research, the data is all over the map, depending on how you define it. So that's one challenge to answering, giving you a real answer to your question. The other challenge is what we see over time is that if we asked this 20 years ago, we would say men engage in infidelity at much higher rates than women. Most of the more recent studies suggest that those rates are fairly similar among men and women. And in some studies, we've been seeing this uptick. And part of that, one argument is that it has to do with how gender dynamics have changed so much, with more households defined as dual career, more heterosexual relationships, at least defined with dual career and people, the availability of the internet and social media to connect with partners. The landscape, the opportunities for infidelity have become much more pervasive, I think. And also what people are considering infidelity. Is it a close emotional connection? Is it a kiss? I mean, even now we just did a study asking about, what about a robot or an AI? If you have an AI chatbot, is that infidelity?
Such a good question.
About half of people think it is, yeah. So they're real. It's really one of the things I struggled with on the infidelity chapter, was really trying to say this, and I've published a lot on infidelity, but the literature's all over the map in terms of how do we define it. But at its core, when I honed in, the real issue people are struggling with when it comes to the strayers is the betrayal piece.
Right.
So although some people feel that desire for sexual novelty pulling them out of their relationship, many relationships find ways to manage that. They say, okay, are we going to open our relationship? Okay, are we going to separate? Oh, we're going to find ways to pull it in and start vacationing and start trying new recipes, insert novelty into our relationship. Or Is it a betrayal and infidelity? And the issue with infidelity is often more so than the sex or connection with another person. It's the loss of trust in the relationship. And the thing that singles, in our Singles in America study, the thing that people want most in a relationship is a partner they can trust and confide in. And once you erode that in some way, it is such a challenge to reestablish from there. So that really becomes this piece of how we think of betrayal. And there are some differences, to flip your question, is there's also some differences in how men and women think about what betrayal is in their relationship.
Well, I wonder whether just how gendered it is. I think probably the old idea is that for men it was about sexual desire and variety. For women it's about lack of love or neglect or looking for love. Is that still true when you see a more 50-50 when it comes to infidelity, having
Yeah,
affairs?
there were all these great studies that looked at it, and not only were these different motivations, but that women were more upset by a male partner engaging in sexual infidelity. Men were more upset with a, I'm sorry, men were more upset by their female partners engaging in sexual infidelity, and women were more upset by their male partners having emotional infidelity. This idea that how reproduction and resources could be distributed. But in a series of newer studies, when you gave people an option three and you said both men and women were equally upset by both, and men and women were equally motivated by both. And what's interesting about that is that research was coming up with this paradigm of looking at these two areas. But in most people's lives, if you say, oh, my partner had an emotional affair, you start to think, well, they basically had sex with him. They probably had sex with him. I think they had sex with him. Or if you say, oh, my partner had a physical affair, but it wasn't emotional, you go, how is it not emotional? Were you those primates that were facing each other? How was it not emotional? There had to be some
Exactly.
connection happening. So we interweave those in our thoughts and in our mind. But we did see some differences on motivation. In one of our studies, we reported about eight different motivations for why people engage in infidelity. We've done some studies looking at genetic factors and then others on motivations. Like self-reported motivations, and we boiled it down to eight. We didn't see big differences, big gender differences, when we looked at those eight motivations, interestingly.
Well, let me tick them off for our listeners. Anger, sexual desire, lack of love, low commitment, esteem, situation, like I was drunk and that's why I had sex with this other person, neglect and variety, which kind of covers the gamut there. But you also say that about half of couples where there is infidelity manage to stay together, which is heartening, I think.
It is. And I think it's so, especially when I used to teach a relationship science class at the university and here at Indiana University. And when we talk about infidelity, they would always say, if someone cheats on me, I'm done. I'm over. I'm not going to stay in this relationship. And I think a lot of us walk around and saying that. And there's a principled reason for it, because there's this idea that it's a betrayal. But then what happens is the reality of a relationship. And you love someone and you've had a betrayal or a violation of your relationship agreement. And what we find is that for many people, they try to work through it. That you might have this idea of how you're going to respond to a challenge in your relationship. But then you're in love, or you have a house, or you have kids, or you're planning a future together. And I think what we see is that for a lot of people, they'll say, well, do I want to judge my whole relationship by this mistake or this problem? And maybe there are other good things. And we, I think, forget about the enormous power of love. When you are really connected to a person, we have positive illusions. We tend to really hone in on the best aspects of our partners when we're in love. We often forget the annoying things about them. And it's something that happens in the brain. But it's also this idea that relationships are complex and that there is a lot of ups and downs that occur. And in fact, about half of people do try to stay. They do try to work through it. And sometimes the relationships are better, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're permanently damaged by that betrayal. That becomes the challenges of sorting through. But it's at its core, I think you're right, it's heartening, and it's a reminder of love bonds, or Mother Nature made those love bonds
That good old
intense, and that
oxytocin, right?
that's why they could survive a lot of challenges.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's Justin Garcia, our guest today on The Connection. He is the executive director of the Kinsey Institute. He's written a new book called called The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. Let me put something else on the on the table for discussion. You say that we are on the precipice of an intimacy crisis. Marriage rates are down. Singlehood is up. Something like 40% of American adults are unpartnered, which I guess means that they don't have a serious mate in their life. What is behind this trend? How new is this and what's driving it?
Yeah, over the last few years, we've been watching the rates of singlehood increase. And on its own, I don't think that's a problem. But when we lay it out with everything else that's going on, so well over, as you said, over 40% of the adult population and at scale in the U.S., we're talking about 120 million people.
That's a lot of people.
And we're starting, we're starting to see this in a lot of other nations as well. In some cases, governments are getting concerned because they're worried about reproductive rates. And there's different patterns of where you can get visas to go to certain countries to find a spouse. Fertility rates are declining in a lot of places. But I think that the singlehood, not everyone who's single is in trouble. There's plenty of people who are single and happy and have other forms of social support. But what most of the research does tell us is that having a long-term partner is associated with better psychological and physical health, not just psychological health. In part, that has to do with the benefits of relationships. Part of some of them are physiological. We were just talking about oxytocin. Oxytocin's really a part of the immune system. So we know people with higher oxytocin, they have faster wound healing.
Right. And that's the so-called love hormone.
It's the love hormone, cuddle hormone. And it's also involved in reproduction and connection. So when I think about this intimacy crisis, it's not just singlehood on its own. It's not any one of those elements on its own. But when they're put together, these high rates of singlehood, the challenges so many people are having in forming relationships today, and whether it's struggling with apps or matchmakers or how to date. We have a brand new study that I didn't have in the book that we found in a sample of Gen Z, 80% say they really want a romantic relationship. They want to be in love. Close to half, a little over 45%, said they didn't think they were ready to be in a relationship with someone. So we're walking around with this idea that we have to work on ourselves before we can be in a relationship, and we forget that relationships are a container to make mistakes, and in the best case, someone's there to catch you when you make those mistakes.
Well, I think that in part describes this so-called loneliness epidemic, where so many people are literally feeling lonely. But you also say, and this is interesting, that the onslaught of bad news can affect our desire for dating and mating. And, you know, I guess when you're in a threatening environment, we kind of shut certain things down because it's all about survival. And if you've got the news on 24/7, you're going to feel under duress and under threat. How does that work? How are we responding to all the sort of bad news that seems to be permeating our mental worlds, if not physical
worlds.
The
word you used is perfect. It's threat. It's that our physiology, our nervous system goes into a threat response. And when we think of it, when it's accumulated, now past generations certainly had stressful things going on. Sure. But when we think of the accumulation of stress, so many people today are worried about, is it the environment? Is it politics? Is it the Middle East? Is it our economy? Is it our healthcare system? Is it our elections? And it doesn't necessarily, I'm not speaking to a particular political party on either side. People are concerned, but I mean, immigration is a great example. It doesn't matter what your party is, you're worried about it right now. And that when that all adds up for us in the nervous system, it can push us over into a threat response. Now, so much of mating, of relationships, of love and sex, it requires a sense of psychological safety. A little bit of threat, now that can be okay, right? You're kissing someone in a car and you might get caught by the park ranger. Okay, maybe that's a little exciting. But a lot of threat, you're probably not stopping the kiss in a burning building. And that one way I always think of it is you'll never see two gazelle mating in front of a lion in the natural world.
Perfect, yes.
And when we're in a threat response, we're really thinking about mobilizing, getting at. We're unable to focus the brain on sociality, on socializing. And so much of love and sex and mating is a subset of sociality. So our bodies are really not able to do it.
And as you say, paradoxically, it's when we're under threat is when we need each other even more.
It's when we need it the most, exactly. Especially right now, this idea to whether one of the core arguments I try to make is that pair bonds evolved 4 million years ago. It helped our species weather uncertainty and weather the storms of life. And we're in a moment of we're in a storm moment right now of a lot of things going on that are unpredictable. That's the challenge when things are unpredictable. And partners are what help us get through that. Whether it's whatever these things are, their sense of calm. The pandemic was a great example. We did a series of studies at the Kinsey Institute on the impact of the pandemic on people's intimate lives. Over 80% of, I think it's close to 85% of marriages did better during the COVID pandemic.
Because they were home, because they were home together.
They were having conversations they never had. They were cooking together in ways they hadn't in years. They were realizing so many people thought, you know, this is a scary time. And the whole reason we did this thing is I've got you across the table next to me on the couch, someone to weather this storm with. It was, an appreciation. Now, sexual frequency decreased for people all over the world. But the relationships, for the most part, did better.
We're almost up on a break here, but explain that. So, yes, people felt more connected, but they didn't necessarily have more sex.
Yes, exactly. And what we found was decreases in sexual frequency, also decreases in masturbation, which was an interesting measure because it suggested desire was decreasing. It wasn't just that, oh, you could have COVID, I don't want to kiss you. There was some of that going on, too. Yeah. So we found these decreases in frequency, and I think it's because people were worried. And they were concerned. We didn't know there was so much uncertainty. About 1 in 5 people tried something new in their sexual life. They were engaging in new novelty. Although I remember interviewing a couple about a year later, and the woman said to me, well, my husband and I, we started having sex in the shower. And I said, oh, that aligns with what we found. It's novelty. You tried something new. And she said, well, partly it was because it was the only way we got 5 minutes to ourselves. The house was always full. So
necessity, the mother of invention, right?
Exactly. But for the people who were in relationships, I mean, even those that weren't, we found in one study, 1 in 4 had sex with a non-romantic roommate during the pandemic.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and we'll pick up on our conversation with Justin Garcia. He's an evolutionary biologist, executive director of the Kinsey Institute, author of a new book called The Intimate Animal. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about mating, dating, love, and infidelity with our guest, Justin Garcia. He is a sex and relationship researcher, also the executive director and senior scientist at the Kinsey Institute. He is chief scientific advisor to the dating company Match, and he's got a new book called The Intimate Animal. Well, let me go back about 75 years when Kinsey came out with their really groundbreaking studies about people's sexual behavior. And I think they probably, I don't think the country is caught up with what Kinsey found 75 years ago, which is that people do pretty wild things in the privacy of their bedroom. So-called, and I'm using quotes here, deviant behavior is not so deviant. It's much more common than was thought, probably more than maybe even the missionary position. But why do you think we're still struggling with understanding sexual behavior? We struggle with sex education, how we teach it, how we talk about sex. It seems we have a kind of, you know, Puritanism on one hand and a kind of prurience on the other hand.
Yeah, it's the interesting thing about sex research and sexuality. And sex research continues to face so many challenges, including legislative attacks and by hate groups. And I find it interesting that attacks on just asking questions or doing research. And then because the assumption is downstream about, okay, how are you teaching it? Is it in schools or is it at home? And what does that mean for people's personal lives? And in fact, you're right, that part of when Dr. Kinsey started the work that now what was for the Institute for Sex Research was founded in 1947. Today it's called the Kinsey Institute. And the two landmark books, Sexual Behavior of the Human Male in 1948 and Sexual Behavior of the Human Female 5 years later in 1953, those books were hugely influential because it was providing data. It was providing evidence of all these things people weren't talking about. America reacted very differently to the women's book 5 years later, the first book.
The women were sexual, right? The women.
Exactly. And people couldn't take it. They started burning the books, but everyone had to buy it to burn it. So it was still a bestseller. So
That's hilarious.
but very different reactions that, because I
Right.
think the idea that people's sisters and mothers and daughters and wives were sexual, and particularly for women, we see what psychologist Deb Tolman calls this a dilemma of desire, particularly for young women, that society sexualizes them, but we don't want them to actually engage in sexual activity. And it's this double bind of, even though that people, particularly young people, particularly women, are often sexualized, when they engage in the behavior, we treat it as if it's some lack of control, or that there's not been, why can't you be more in charge of your own sexual impulses or your desires? This idea that pleasure can and should be a part of our sexual lives, they're not just procreative. And I think often, I mean, we see even today with groups that we'll talk to that there's often a lot of very strong ideas about what sex education is. And there's often this idea that if you talk about or you study sex, it's going to make people more sexual, too sexual. And often people, I think a lot of it is stigma about challenges people feel when they see others that are free and comfortable with their sexuality. So if you're not free and comfortable with your sexuality and you see the others that are, that it can be so jarring. I think that's where a lot of where we see the hate and the stigma in this world, but in the around issues of sex and gender and reproduction comes from, sadly. And on the point on sex ed, just to add one data point from a paper we published recently, we asked people their sources of sex education. We asked adults, most of the sex education literature is on adolescents. We asked a sample of adults, did you get enough sex education in your current relationships? Do you think, would you have liked to have known more? 44% of adults told us, if I had just had a little bit more comprehensive sex ed, I'd have healthier and happier relationships today. Half of Americans are just saying they wish they had some knowledge to help shape the current relationships. And then we asked where they got their sources of sex ed and different types. And I'll hone in on one. We found less than 20% of people did their parents or caregivers ever talk to them about consent. So this idea that sex ed can and should only happen in the home, I mean, there's this whole political debate, and I in some ways sit outside it as a researcher at a nonpartisan organization, but it's alarming to me that when people have this argument that, sex ed shouldn't be in schools, it should only be in the home. Well, okay, but the reality is when we look at the data, most homes are either not comfortable or not equipped to have those conversations with youth. And the bottom line is they aren't. The fact that less than 1 in 5 ever talked about consent at home, that's a problem.
Well, but I'm also thinking that we are in many ways awash, if not awash, a click away from pornography. And I'm not saying that's necessarily about sex education. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, and I guess you could get educated from it or by it. So there's an interesting, again, this sort of interesting conflict about feeling either uninformed or ignorant, but also having kind of a sea of information around us.
Exactly. And you could watch pornography and you could walk away and say, oh, penetrative intercourse leads to orgasm for both men and women every time. Well, turn the data tells us that less than a quarter of women orgasm from penetrative behaviors alone. So you can watch pornography. It's not a good source of sex education in terms of mutual pleasure, in terms of respect, in terms of contraceptive use. And you could walk away with really biased or ill-informed ideas about what real people's sexual lives look like. They're messy and they're complicated, and sometimes your hip hurts and sometimes you can't find your pillow, and but those realities of what people's intimate lives look like, and for me that's the real source of intimacy. If you're in a long-term relationship with a person, how do you explore love and sex when you pulled your back out and you're trying to still be intimate with your partner? Those are people's real lives. That's not what we're getting on a pornography.
Let me add something else, and this is something that you write in the book. The things people are looking for in a partner run the gamut from companionship to safety to sex, and the body mind respond differently to environmental stimuli. That is why a person's sexual orientation, identity, and preference may be heterosexual, but in certain situations, his or her behavior may be bisexual or even exclusively same sex. And I still think we're stuck in this sort of binary view of sexual orientation and sexual identity, when what people tell us and what behavior tells us is that it's so much broader than that.
Exactly. And and sometimes we can imagine cases where, let's say, you might identify as heterosexual and you're in prison for 10 years. And you might then, well, it turns out that a lot of men who are in prison have boyfriends. And they sometimes do it for safety. They sometimes do it for companionship. Now, is it their primary preference? Well, if they weren't in prison, they might want an opposite sex partner. But we respond to our environments and our ecology. So as a researcher, we always look at behavior and your preference and your identity as three different pieces that shape our sexual orientations. And they can be responding to environments, they can be responding to who's available, who makes you feel safe. And in fact, there's also a lot of rates of people who experiment. So if we look at data on how many men and women identify as heterosexual or bisexual, and how many had a same-sex sexual encounter this last year, many more are engaging in same-sex encounters than who identify as gay, lesbian, or bi. So those are all windows into telling us there's a lot of flexibility. And that doesn't mean it's lifelong. Plenty of people, particularly often when they're younger, if they're in college or around that age, they experiment with the borders of their romantic and sexual lives, of what structures they like. Do you want an open relationship or a closed relationship? Do you want to kiss someone of the same gender? So that doesn't necessarily define someone's orientation.
Orientation. Let's talk a little about, I guess, what is, this sounds a little clunky, but consensual non-monogamous relationships. I guess polyamory would be part of that. I did interview a couple about a year or so ago that were in a polyamorous relationship, and it seemed like a lot of work. I'll just put it that way. A lot of sort of navigating, a lot of intentionality, which I think is probably a good thing. But how do you see people sort of experimenting with dyads and triads and, all the other permutations?
Yeah, and there was a term that used to be used. It was ethical non-monogamy, and then we all started using consensual non-monogamy because we said, "Who's ethics?" And now researchers are saying, "Well, both parties always consenting, so maybe we should just call it negotiated non-monogamy." So the terms keep changing, or disclosed non-monogamy. And what we find is, and I think that my caution is that sometimes there's a tendency to say, okay, well, monogamous couples do this well, and non-monogamous or negotiated non-monogamous couples do that well. And the reality is there's different challenges. You're absolutely right that and if you're in a negotiated non-monogamy relationship, you just have more to negotiate. You have more to work through. There's more people, there's more concerns, there's more pleasures, there's more challenges, there's more of everything. To work through. That's just a different challenge. For some people, that's a welcome challenge. In others, it's too much. But there are people who do non-monogamy well and unwell, and there are people who do long-term commitment and fidelity well and not well. So, for those who are in negotiated or open non-monogamous relationships and they're functioning well, and what by that I mean characterized by satisfaction, low conflict, there's a lot of communication happening. But there's also a lot of there's still boundaries. There's still infidelity in non-monogamous relationships. But what are those boundaries? Maybe it's don't ask, don't tell. Maybe you're traveling for work and I don't want to know what happens. Maybe it's always use condoms or not you can't be with anyone we know, or it can only be one time and not a relationship. Lots of different structures. And what's interesting of this big umbrella of consensual non-monogamy, there's a lot of different types that fall in there. You brought up polyamory, which is plural love, which is a different than necessarily just lots of sexual partners, or even I shouldn't say lot, or just more than one sexual partner. Polyamory is this idea that you have multiple love bonds, and that also is something that is quite different. And I think about pair bonds, and we typically think of pair bonds as one at a time. Psychologists define romantic love as focused attention, intrusive thought, obsessive thinking. That's kind of hard to have for more than one person at a time. And but some people do, and how they manage that. And what we see is for those people who are in these relationships with multiple partners, often the different partners are doing different things. They occupy different needs. So maybe there's one that you really talk to about the work, and there's one that you really talk to about emotional stuff. So we For the well, those that work well, and I keep cautioning when I say well, but with high satisfaction, we see that there's kind of a disbursement in the relationships. They're not all, you're not trying to do the same two things, because that can create so much conflict and jealousy, which can be difficult to manage.
Well, let me segue from that to what is described as the sex recession, the idea that couples are having less sex. First of all, is that true? And do you think that's a problem? Is it a matter of quantity, quality? What do the numbers say? What do you say? What do the researchers say?
I love that you asked it that way, because it's the two-part question. And so the one part is it true? Yes. And for a while, it was sort of inside baseball for sex researchers. We were seeing in different data sets, colleagues in different parts of the globe, we were starting to see these decreases in sexual frequency. And at the time, people were saying, something's going on here. What's going on here? There were small but observable differences in overall populations and frequency of sexual activity. Now, that's been well documented now, that there are decreases. And in some cases, it's in people in relationships more so than singles. They're not huge decreases, but there's decreases in a lot of data sets. The second part of your question, though, that's the important piece. Yes, there's a relative, somewhat small decrease in a number of times people have a sexual event in a year on average. But what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And is sexual quality going down? Is sexual satisfaction? Is relationship satisfaction? Is desire? Those are the pieces of the puzzle that we don't quite know yet. We've actually just launched a study with several of my colleagues at the Kinsey Institute where we're looking at that. What are the real qualitative aspects of that? Because a decrease in behavior isn't necessarily bad. Maybe that's making room for more relational activities. Maybe relationship satisfaction is higher than it's ever been. So we have to really couch what that pattern means. I think people are worried about it because of the lower fertility rates. And there's a thought that there may be related, but I'm not convinced that's the case. It's a topic that's gotten a lot of headlines, but what it really means for our relationships, that's still to be determined.
Let me ask you about something that happened this week. The U.S. Supreme mm-hmm. Court ruled 8-1 that Colorado's law that banned something called conversion therapy was an egregious assault. That's the language of the Supreme Court on the First Amendment. This is a therapy that seeks to change a teenager's sexual orientation or their gender identity. It's been actually condemned by, you know, all the major professional organizations. But as someone mm-hmm. who's the executive director of Kinsey and has dug deep into people's sexual orientation and behavior, what do you make of this Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And there's more there than if you're not steeped in thinking about what conversion therapy is, that is not necessarily obvious. So many of us, when we think of conversion therapies, we think of, you know, a pray the gay away camp, this idea mm-hmm. that young people are sent to places that they often experience psychological and physical abuse. And that did happen. And that's part of our history, both in the U.S. and other places of the world. Every legitimate major behavioral health organization has come out against this. It doesn't work. It's not particularly effective. It has long-term psychological harm. It can cause stress and anxiety. It doesn't really achieve its goals. Now, currently, that language of conversion therapy is also being deployed to think about what are called sexual orientation and gender identity change efforts, is what the academic literature calls it. So that includes that for a long time, there were people, young people in particular, who were gender nonconforming, would go to, often first you have to go to a psychotherapist. And part of the treatment in many places was first to get young people to align with their biological sex. So if you have a young, if you have a adolescent who comes in and they, let's say it's a natal boy who says, I want to be a girl. And you'd say, well, maybe you just are a gay boy. And talk therapy. So this case was about talk therapy. And it starts to go through that. And so that, it's a lot what was going on behind that. But the interestingly, we now know that it's both psychological and physical health. A new study showed that cardiovascular health was negatively impacted by conversion therapy. So they have long-term negative effects on our well-being.
Well, I hate to leave it there. Justin Garcia, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Executive Director of the Kinsey Institute, author of this new book we've been talking about called The Intimate Animal. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You could download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find the show on Facebook. Debbie Bilder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us. And Al Banks has been our engineer.